This is the Life Truth Network.
Quest for our Truth, Episode 470.
Quest for Truth, presented by Protectorate Productions and HPN, Helpsley Podcast Network. Now located at life-truth.com. And now, here is your host, making moles out of a groundhog, Keith Helpsley.
Hey, everybody. Welcome. This is your host, Keith. We are listening to Quest for Truth. We have a solo episode for you today. Hey, I have a few announcements, or at least an important one I want to get to before we get into our main topic of the day, which I will be returning to my quest through church history. I'm using a book. I'll give you all the credits so we get to the main topic. It's an adventure for me as I review this chapter. I probably want to make it about halfway through the fifth chapter in this book. It's not that long, but it's kind of intense. I did some things with footnotes I didn't do in previous sessions. I'll tell you more about that, too, whenever we get that part. But for now, our important announcement is that we are part of the Christian podcast community. And we always like to play promos for that, and we'll get to that also in a little bit. But there are some changes. There's some technical changes, behind-the-scenes changes, that there will be some transferring of servers going on. And when they do, there is a very good chance that our podcast episodes may drop off of their main RSS feed. If they do, well, I have a message for you from a highly trained, highly skilled podcast voiceover artist who will tell you all about it. Hey, this is your host, Keith, and I'd like to ask for you to support our show directly by simply subscribing to our RSS feed. If you're not already doing so, and if you think you are, well, follow along and listen to my computer voice, and we'll work through this together. First of all, visit life-truth.com, and when you're there, near the top, you'll find a menu button that's collapsed.
Life Truth, visitor, link, primary menu, navigation.
There's that primary menu button. Just tap it, and it'll expand, and you'll find one of the options.
Subscribe to a podcast. Current page. Visitor. Link.
And I'm already on this page because it says current page. So all you have to do is find this first heading.
Subscribe to a podcast. Heading level 1. Banner. Landmark.
There's several options. I'm using my iPhone, and you can hear voiceover talking, of course. So let's see the options.
Apple Podcasts. Link.
And there's the very first one telling us to subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And all it takes is tapping that, and you'll find yourself with your Apple Podcast opening up, where at the very top of the page, you're going to find this.
Follow it. Artwork. Life Truth Network Master Feed. Image. Life Truth Network Master Feed.
And there you have it.
Keith Helpsley and Nathaniel D. Caldwell.
And you notice it said that you're following, and this is how you can follow us and not miss any of our episodes. And so I would appreciate that you do that. And this has been your host, Keith. Thanks for following and thanks for supporting us. Okay. Highly trained, skilled podcast voiceover artist. Yeah. I wonder who that could have been. There you have it. Now you know how you'll never miss one of our shows ever in the future if you just follow those simple instructions. And maybe you're already following us, but if you follow those steps, you'll make sure that you are indeed doing that. And, of course, there's other options besides Apple. You can follow us using your Google device, PC, other options. Just find the one that's right for you and repeat those same kind of steps. Anyway, enough about that. But we do like to mention the rest of the good folks on the Christian podcast community, where you hear voices that sound a lot like these right here.
Unbelievers now have no excuse to misinterpret the Bible like they ever did. Interpreting the Bible has never been easier or less expensive. Get your copy of What Does It Mean to Me? This teaches and demonstrates the importance of biblical interpretation. Proper biblical interpretation is the difference between truth and error, life and death, heaven and hell. This is created for your sinos. That's your Christians in name only. Readers will stop asking, what does this mean to me? And start asking, what does it mean? Get your copy of What Does It Mean to Me at trackplanet.com or on amazon.com today. You want to get this before it's too late.
Hey there, friends, family, foes, and lurkers alike. This is Daniel Minnick, the host of the Truth Espresso podcast on the Christian podcast community. And I want you to check out Voice of Reason Radio with Chris Honholtz and Richard Story. Chris and Rich are two guys with big hearts who will bring you a show every week that is sure to be challenging, encouraging, and biblical. Voice of Reason Radio with Chris Honholtz and Richard Story is part of the Christian podcast community. Check them out at slavetotheking.com. That's slavetotheking.com. And tell them Truth Espresso sent you.
Parenting isn't about us. In fact, parenting isn't even about our kids. Parenting is just one way Christian dads and moms are to worship God. So welcome to the Truth Love Parent Podcast, where we train dads and moms to give God the preeminence in their parenting.
I'm your host, A.M. Brewster, and today we bring our biblical parenting essentials.
If you've ever wanted to have me visit your local church, your school, camp, some ministry of some kind, or home even, to speak on how God would have us to parent our kids, or any other family topics, please visit truthloveparent.com and click on the speaking tab. And please, of course, share this whole series on your favorite social media outlets so that other Christian parents can mature in their parenting. Subscribe to the show and follow it for weekly encouragement. And if you and or your family need some specialized and individualized help, please write to us at counselor@truthloveparent.com or leave a voicemail at 828-423-0894. Listen, I love you more than you realize. I love your family equally, and I'm honored to be invited to serve you at this important time in your life. So, Lord willing, I'll see you soon. Truth Love Parent is part of the Evermind Ministries family and is dedicated to helping you worship God through your parenting. So join us next time as we study God's Word to learn how to parent our children for life and godliness. And remember that TLP is a listener-supported ministry. You can visit truthloveparent.com/donate to learn more.
Main topic.
We're turning to my look at church history. A book called "Learn to Talk: The History of the Christian Church." It is by Williston Walker, Richard A. Norris, David W. Lotz, Robert T. Hamby. Copyright 1918, 1959. 1970, 1985, Charles Scribner's Sons, copyright renewed 1946, Amelia Walker Gushing, and Elizabeth Walker. I want to make sure I get all the accreditation there. I'd like to point out that this book might still be in public domain, given the last time the copyright was renewed in 1946. And I have noticed that given the original print date of 19, 18, it does talk about some things that would not have been known until the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, but those are probably one of those later reprints there. But we'll look at chapter 5 today. This will be on Paul and Gentile Christianity. Now, I'll probably end up stopping about halfway through because it's kind of long. There are some footnotes. This book is, of course, as heavily footnoted as most good historical references are. I haven't really been mentioning footnotes because a lot of it thus far has referred to other historical writings. In earlier chapters, some of the footnotes related to some of the apocryphal books, but you know, between the Testament and apocryphal books. I don't have access to those. I might have access to those, but at the time I really didn't know and I really didn't care. But this chapter, probably the previous one too, but especially this chapter talking about Paul, there are a lot of, well, in fact, all the footnotes refer to scriptural passages, so I'll probably be inserting a little step aside peppered throughout my review of just what was Paul's missionary, or not ministry, ministry life like, and how he got there. But Paul and Gentile Christianity, and this is really kind of the crux of what we know of all of our Christianity today. And of course, from here, we'll pivot and step away, to put our backs to the time of Christ and go through the church history. But this is a really important chapter here. So let me get started without any further ado. And of course, I'm not reading this per se, just using kind of a book review, you might say, of church history, because I've never done it before. This book is my breaking ground territory here on such topics. Not that I haven't studied historical things, but not systematically. But first of all, the beginning of the movement, there was a persecution we talked about before. Stephen's martyrdom kind of kicked everything off in Jerusalem. You recall at the Passover, what we now would refer to Resurrection Sunday, all the Jews were there celebrating Passover. They had this little instance there happening, a little kerfuffle. You might remember this guy named Jesus being crucified. Yeah, it kind of put a dark image on the weekend. And then for the next seven weeks, Jesus was seen out and about talking to his disciples, and suddenly that last week became Pentecost. He arose, and a lot of Jews were there, became believers, and they all stayed there. They stayed there beyond Pentecost, and all of a sudden the diaspora or scattered Jews flocked to Jerusalem. And they got to be so many of those Hellenistic Jews that it was starting to cause some issues. And it came to a boil when Stephen was martyred. You might remember that the Hellenistic Jews kind of looked down on you. You might say they were the progressives of their type, of their time. Just like we have progressive Christian denominations. It wasn't that they weren't Jews, but they tended to bring a lot of Greek and mystical and Greek philosopher stuff into the religion. And the Jews at Jerusalem resented that. And now they see this crowd is not only Hellenistic, but they have this whole Jesus thing happening. And it ends up with Stephen being stoned. And it's like, if you can imagine, all these Jews pouring into a huge bucket. And all of a sudden, somebody drops a big bowling ball into it, and it splashes back out. And they all, once again, disperse. And that dispersal is the initial spark, that catalyst, that made the church spread. Not all, that's some own words, because there's about a sentence devoted to that, but I wanted to summarize and recap a little bit about what's happening with this movement. But the persecution started all this Now, this capital in the Seleucid monarchy, and I had to look that word up, Antioch was a large cosmopolitan Jewish community. The message about Jesus was preached to the Gentile God believers. And let's pause right there, because there's where I have my note. Seleucid monarchy refers, I'd look this up on Wikipedia, refers to a series of monarchs that were assigned by the ruling empire. It's kind of a handshaking of empires from Greek to Egypt, and it included a wide region from Greek to Egypt, even up to Persia. And there was a series of kings. They ruled in the first two or three centuries before Christ. And that's, I think, also whenever the Roman Empire was taking things over as well. But the territory was there, this Seleucid Empire, this region. But the point here is Antioch was basically the capital. It was the capital city of all that. And so you have a major gathering there as these Greek Jews were being persecuted by the Palestinian Jews. Let that word sink in. Palestinian Jews. They saw it as a good time to chase them all away, to keep their religion pure without too many extra pollutions into it. But the Christian assemblies began to grow, and they weren't required to be Christian proselytes or Jewish proselytes. We mentioned that before with this, is that if you were going to be a Jewish proselyte, you're going to be won over into the Jewish faith. You had to follow all the laws. You couldn't just tippy-toe into it. They expected you to jump right in and obey all the laws. Now, I suppose there'd be some coaching before you were officially proselyted, if that's a word. But they expected these new, there were Greek Jews, and they kind of probably uncomfortably accepted them, but the new Greek Christians, they were not Jewish. This is where the rub came in, and this is what was happening with this persecution. But of course, the people in Antioch began to be called Christians. It wasn't a term that caught on right away. It's probably derogatory. That's how a lot of proud ethnic names begin. The early America Revolutionary War time frame was when they started calling people a Yankee Doodle. It was not a nice term. I would like to tell you what it means, but this is a religious broadcast, and I'm not going to do that. Look it up or email me separately. But it was not nice. But sometimes those not nice terms, you claim it, you own it, and this is what happened with the word Christians. It wasn't taken hold until later. But there's a question began to seriously be looked at, where could people who were not ethnic Jews become part of the assembly, the ecclesia? Now, the ecclesia is the Greek word for the assembly. But if the rule of law were imposed on these new converts, well, the church would be fine with that. But if the church didn't require that, then there was going to be a problem with accepting them, and it would give them maybe a mission to start with these people to proselytize them. But this is where Paul enters in. He definitely we'll proceed as we go. But let's talk about Paul's background. His Hebrew name was Saul, and it was, of course, named after King Saul of Benjamin. He was born in the Cilician city of Tarsus. His father was a Roman citizen as well as a Jew. Now, I'm going to kind of stick by what this historian has in this book, but I have a slightly differing opinion on some things here. At the time of his birth, Tarsus was an intellectual cultural center. It was the center of Greek Stoic teaching. This author says there's no reason to believe that he received a Greek-style education, being brought up as a good little Jew. Now, of course, Greek would have been his primary language. And living in that culture, he would have definitely been exposed to the Greek culture, much like a modern-day Jewish boy might grow up in New York City or New Jersey, and you're right in the middle of culture from everywhere. It would just be there. So he would not have been unaware of it, whether he would have been officially trained in it. And I can go for that. Now, in Acts, it finds Paul claiming he was brought up in Jerusalem at the feet of Gamaliel. And we find this in our first footnote in Acts 22. Is that right? Acts 22:3, I'm a Jew, born of Tarsus in Cilicia, but brought up in this city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you are today. Now, of course, Gamaliel was a famous teacher of the law, and this may be the case, and this author supposes that they moved from Tarsus, which is not really a confirmation in any of his writings. There didn't seem to be a lot that Paul had to do with Jerusalem until after his conversion. Now, let me paint my own mental picture here. Because Paul, he went by Saul. If you pay attention in the book of Acts, he's always called Saul up until the time he has to claim that he's a Roman citizen. Why are you beating me for? I'm a Roman citizen. And this happens well into the book of Acts, because he got tired of taking him to beating, and I don't blame him for that. So, but up until that time, he was always Saul. He only claimed Paul when he needed to invoke that citizenship. But the point here is I can see, because if he was a Roman citizen, I always imagined that possibly his father was Roman and his mother was Jewish, which still would work, because the mother... then and even now, if you think about it, even outside the Jewish realm, whatever the religion the mom is, because the mom has the kids for the first 6 or so years of their life, 6 or 8 years, then back then they would get passed off to dad to get family training in their business. You know, these days they send them off to elementary school. But for those first few years, you know, mom was instilling their religious beliefs that last a lifetime. There's a lot of religious training in those first years that molds who we become later. And so he could have claimed his Jewishness from his mother's side, which is how Jews did that back then and even today. And then he could have, it didn't really matter much then religiously what his father did. But it could be that they both were Jews, and he claimed Roman citizenship because, well, he was born there. That's like saying, hey, I'm a Jew, but I'm born in America. That would make you an American as well as a Jew, and you could claim that citizenship. And I think that's maybe what's happening. And then when he says he was trained, he was brought up in Jerusalem at the feet of Gamaliel, I imagine that he went there. I don't know when precisely they started doing bar mitzvahs and stuff like that. I know I read some debate about this some time ago. So my mind is rusty, but it seems like it doesn't appear clearly until about 1,000 years later. But it could have been going on even back in his early days in the first century, possibly before. I'm going to guess probably was. And so for that to happen, he would have had to have official training. It's possible the family migrated there early on, which still would not have made him any less a Roman citizen since they would have moved there. Or it could be that he did his training as a teenager, because you typically did your trade that you were going to learn during your teenage years, but we later know he was a tent maker. So there's a lot of fuzziness. It's not really that important. It's a curious thing to wonder about. If it was all that important, Paul would have wrote it down, and he never saw fit to do so. All we know is he was a tent maker, which I don't think this chapter addresses that. But this is interesting to piece out and ponder over his early education. Now this thing, statement X, is also consistent with his statements elsewhere. He was devoted to the law of the Pharisees. He insists that his own conduct was beyond reproach, and he probably used that to persecute the church. His motivation, his zealousness for that faith, being an Acts, of course, claims he was present for Stephen's stoning, but it was in Stephen, in his Hellenistic ways, that would have kind of epitomized what Paul stood against in those early days, people polluting his beloved religion, as it were. Now, our second note is in Galatians 1:14. I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my contemporaries among my countrymen, being more extremely zealous for my ancestral traditions. So we're going to see a lot of these footnotes coming from Galatians and Acts and Romans and the Corinthians as we go through, because this is where Paul lays out his resume, as it were. But it should be no surprise that he didn't really persecute the Palestinian Jews. It was just the Hellenistic Jews who were in Palestine, in Jerusalem area. Those are the ones he really persecuted. But then you have to wonder, because if it was on those who, in his eyes, were bending the law in his country, why was he going to Tarsus? Well, let's look at that real quick, because Tarsus was, a city outside of Jerusalem. And Paul's conversion, let's have a look at this. The dates of his history is a little uncertain. This conversion is a little bit fuzzy. And I've noticed that is in the Bible, especially in Acts, it doesn't say in the third year of the reign of Herodias, or the second year of fifth month of the 14th day of King so-and-so. It doesn't really do that. Excuse me, I had to take a moment to cough. but it doesn't specify time, but as near as people can nail it down, his conversion probably happened about 5 years after the death of Christ. And for Paul to be at Stephen's martyrdom and not do any stoning because he just watched the cloaks, as we find out in various writings, it probably would have been a teenager still, probably less than 20, because 20 was the age of fighting and going off to war and that kind of thing. So I would imagine that's why. But now he is of age, these some years later, and so we might surmise that he might have been, say, 15 at the time of the crucifixion, and now he's 20, and now he's out there tormenting those Hellenistic Jews that are in his beloved Palestine, Jerusalem. But we could just, like I said, surmise and conjecture about these things. But he it says here he tried to terrorize them by disciplinary means. Well, no, he tried to kill them. I mean, he may not have actually been the one to kill them, but he did have warrants to bring people to Jerusalem to stand trial, and I think they were killing them. But in other words, what he would have been doing is gathering up the Hellenistic Jews to have them face consequences. But once they fled, they would have been really no reason to go after them, because now they're not there in the city raising up a fuss. But he had this vision, and he came to realize that once he encountered Christ, it's no longer him living, but Christ living in him. And we find this when he made this statement in Galatians 2:20, I have been crucified with Christ, and it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself up for me. Now, he became, what's the word? He became convinced that it was all about fellowship with Jesus that was needed for salvation, and not simply obeying the law. Not that the law wasn't important, as we'll find out as we go along here. But his early ministry, in the case of Paul, his conversion showed immediately. He was on the way to Damascus, and he right away after his conversions seemed to have preached his gospel pretty early on there in the area. We find this in 2 Corinthians 11:32. In Damascus, the ethnarch under Aranus the king was guarding the city of the Damascenes. I hope I said it all right. In order to seize me. It seems a little out of context, but he's saying, you know, this is one place where he actually does give the names of rulers at this particular time and this particular king. So we do know that this is kind of where he began his actually preaching the gospel there. It goes on that after this, 3 years after his conversion, he made a 2-week visit to Jerusalem to visit Cephas or Peter, and also James, the Lord's brother, as well. And we find this in Galatians 1:18, which pretty much says just that. He went to Jerusalem to become acquainted with Cephas, stayed 15 days, and so forth. So next comes just about a decade, which there's not an awful lot where he just spent time possibly founding churches in the vicinity of where he was from and around Tarsus. He just kind of settled in this Hellenistic area, Seleucian area, governed by the kings of the realm, as it were, but certainly not under Israel. But eventually, he and Barnabas went to Jerusalem, and Barnabas also was from Cyprus, and he may also be one who was at the martyrdom of Stephen and dispersed. But we find that Acts 11:25, he left for Tarsus to look for Saul. He meaning Barnabas, left to look for Saul. I'm trusting that the historian has these footnotes and context, and they pretty much do. I just kind of get uncomfortable reading just a disjointed verse like that to prove a point. So look them up on your own. Though there was an early church crisis here too, because Christian visitors apparently went to Antioch, and in accordance with the tradition of the church, you need to be circumcised or you couldn't be saved. You also couldn't participate in the temple. Now, in Acts 15:1, some men came down from Judea and began teaching to the brethren. Unless you're circumcised, according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. So when Paul and Barnabas had great dissension and debate with them, their brothers determined that Paul and Barnabas and some others should go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders concerning this issue. Now, see, if they would have said, if you're not circumcised, you can't be in a temple, that's more precisely the thing. But I don't know that the Abrahamic tradition meant that you couldn't be saved, but you just couldn't be part of the assembly. You had to, like, again, be, you know, a fully proselyte to be that. And so what they're trying to say is, okay, you Greek people who are not Jews, we understand you believe in Christ, but we need to pull you into our ways. You need to have these legal things done. And so we find Barnabas and Saul getting into a debate, as they took even an uncircumcised Gentile to go meet with the leaders there. That would have been the meeting with Paul and Peter and others. We can find this in Galatians 2:1-10. And there's also an account in Acts 15. This seems to be the same account. And they pretty much agree. They each shed a little more details than the other. Probably Acts is more detailed than the one in Galatians. But they don't disagree. It's just one shares different details than the other. But the leaders of the Jerusalem church and this new Greek church came to an agreement. And they determined that the gospel was available to both Greeks and Jews. And they walked away saying that just to treat the widows and orphans well. Because, you know, that's an age-old thing. I think I mentioned this before. It goes back to at least Isaiah, where I'm going to paraphrase it. It says that the service to the widows and orphans is the highest form of worship. And all they're saying is, like, just keep the main thing the main thing. Salvation is about Christ, but worship is helping those who can't help themselves. That's kind of my own take on that. Of course, that's found in Galatians 2:9-10. Is where you can find that written out. I won't read it at the moment. But also in the, so I missed something here. In Acts 15, it required the Gentile Christians to abstain from the pollutions of idols and unchastity, or to strangle from blood. In other words, it was about table fellowship, you know, taking meals together, not eating meat to idols and so forth. In Acts 15:20, but that we write to them, they abstain from contaminating from idols and fornication, from what is strangled and from blood. And so, yeah, in other words, don't mess with the dietary laws. If you're going to fellowship with Jews, they're just kind of fencing out what they'll be acceptable. If you want to fellowship and come and claim you're part of us, they're basically saying you don't have to be proselytes. We have this common faith with belief in Christ, but as Jews, we kind of are balking here on these points with Paul. Indicates that this table fellowship came later. Indicates the problem arose after conference in Galatians, and his letters seem to indicate that he didn't have any knowledge of it. Maybe he didn't find it important to write about it probably isn't all that important to Paul, then I'm not going to worry about it personally. But we can find more about that in Galatians 2:11-13. But when the Cephas came to Antioch, he put him to his face. He is still condemned prior to coming of certain men. He used to eat with Gentiles, but when they came, he began to withdraw and be aloof, fearing the circumcision party. So, in other words, Paul called him out on that, saying it shouldn't be that big of an issue, this whole eating of meats and whatnot. And so, let's see, this author says he may be recounting something that became a tradition in his own day. And, you know, religious traditions come and go. And I can see the Jewish point. You don't want to, if you have dietary laws, you want to not eat anything. You want to keep kosher, would be the phrase, I suppose. But Paul is just saying, you know, that's not a requirement for salvation. The only thing that's a requirement for salvation is belief in Christ. And after that, we should strive to follow as many commands as we can, but not because by doing more so will save us anymore. Once you're saved, you're saved. It's just that doing that shows your gratitude and obedience for the salvation. Let's see. His first missionary journey of Paul, it's probably at about the time of the apostolic conference that he, guided by the Spirit, took him out to Perga, Iconia, Lystra, Derbe, the first missionary journey. I think I missed a name or two in there. But you can find that in Acts, I think, 13-14. But on the return from this trip is where the debate over eating with Gentile Christians came about. Again, it's Galatians 2:11-12 or so. I won't read that again. Look it up. But this disagreement wasn't really a bedrock issue of salvation. It also didn't touch ritual prescriptions of the law, like circumcision, which this author says was already settled. But Paul didn't want to compromise even on this whole eating meat, you know, table fellowship, because, again, you're not justified through law, you're justified through faith. And you know, even if a person was to retain that bad habit in the eyes of the Jews, to Paul, he's saying it's not a deal breaker. You know, there's a lot of things modern Christians say, oh, that's a sin. Smoking is a sin. Drinking is a sin. Those are things that certainly are, like, you know, prostitution or drugs or stuff like that. But if you're a Christian and you're still struggling with that, I don't see that being a huge issue. But a struggle is just that. It's an ongoing process. Sometimes you get somebody new to the faith and they haven't tamed their tongue quite yet. And sometimes you might be in a particular class or environment and you hear what I like to call my brother's army words slipping out. It wouldn't have to be army words. It could be truck driver words or whatever. But sometimes it happens, but it shouldn't be a deal breaker. You can still be saved and work through that. Which, I'm going to hold my tongue there because I'm talking about church history. We can find more about that in Galatians, again, 2:16, which is part of this passage we've been talking about in Galatians. But here in this debate, Barnabas seems to have taken the side of Peter. And so when Paul sets out again, he chose Silas for his companion, while Barnabas took Mark and sailed away. Now, I think there's a lot more to that little scuffle. I think it had some to do with Mark and Paul having a disagreement. And it was, I don't think Barnabas sided so much with Peter as he felt that Mark was getting a short end of the stick, or in some ways, and he felt that Paul's riff with him was not correct or something. Acts 15:39-40, there occurred such a sharp disagreement that they separated from one another, and Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus. But Paul chose Silas and left, being committed by the brethren of the grace of the Lord. I think it's really, if you read that in context, it's more of an argument that Mark wasn't meeting up to Paul's standards or ideals there. And an interesting thing, that tail end of that passage, let me find it here. Paul chose Silas and left, being committed by their brethren of the grace of the Lord. Now, he's talking about Silas being grace of the brethren of the Lord. And there's the whole thing I've heard lately, I'm going to try to keep my tongue short here, about being apostles, modern-day apostles. But even back then, once the age of the apostles, the living people there, you don't pass down your apostleship, but you can, the body of elders can call and train and ordain others to call and train and so forth. But apostleship has still come directly from Christ. And I don't think Christ is doing that these days anymore. Anyway, I'll keep it short. Paul's second and greater journey comes, and he's trying to win obedience from the Gentiles. He's trying to plant the gospel in all of the civilized world of the Roman Empire. We look at, where'd it go? Romans 15:1-18. I do not presume to speak of anything other than what Christ accomplished in me, resulting in obedience by the Gentiles in a word and deed. Also in Romans 15:24, Romans 15:24-25, whenever I go to Spain, for I hope to see you in passing and to be helped on my way there by you, when I first enjoyed your company for a while, but now I am going to Jerusalem serving the saints. So we see there, Paul setting out on excursions in wider and wider areas in the empire. Also in Galatians, I almost forgot, 4:13, it was because of a bodily illness I preached the gospel to you the first time. Oh, okay, I don't know why that verse, that passage is in there, but it seems to not fit. But his journeying, it's there because this author says, his journey is with hopes that he will return to communities that he has already founded in Asia Southern Minor. He had already been taken illness, as the passage spoke of. But with his companions, he left Asia Minor, went to Macedonia, via Ignatia, Adriatic Sea, and Italy. I'm kind of stringing those together. We had founded communities at Philippi, Thessalonica, which was the seat of the government in Macedonia. He was diverted when trouble at Thessalonica forced him to leave by night, being let down over the wall by a basket. And he turned towards central Greece. So, you know, it's interesting. All the, you know, we talk about Israel being the Holy Land, but this area, this, you know, modern-day Turkey, modern-day Greece, this is also Christian Holy Land that the apostles spread. And it's just so disheartening to know that Christians aren't welcome there. It's all Muslim, and you're not, it's not welcome there. But persecution pursued him. He went south to Corinth by way of Athens. At Corinth, he spent 15 months preaching and teaching. Titius Justus' house. Then he went to he went with the Roman. Let me talk here. He traveled with Aquila and Priscilla. There's the words. He went to Ephesus. He left them, and then he went to Palestine and Antioch, and he took time to revisit those churches in Phrygia and Galatia. In other words, he's coming back full circle. But on the return to Ephesus, he began a ministry of several years, possibly AD 53 to 56. Let's see, Acts 19, 8 and 10. Then he entered the synagogue and continued speaking out boldly for 3 months, reasoning, persuading them about the kingdom of God. But when some were becoming hardened and disobedient, speaking evil of the way before the people, he withdrew from them and took away the disciples, reasoning daily in the school of Duranus. This took place for 2 years, so that all who lived in Asia heard the word of the Lord, both Jews and Greeks. So there is that. Now, there's a statement here in that verse, so we can find it here. Some were becoming hardened and disobedient, speaking evil of the way. The way, of course, is what the Christians actually called themselves back then, before they accepted that word as their new identity. But the way, they were being disobedient towards them. And this is Paul's goal. He wants people to become obedient towards towards God by using the way. But this ministry produced his Corinthian letters, also his Galatian letter, Philippian, and Philemon during this time frame, this 53 to 56. He left Ephesus, went back to Corinth for a 3 month stay. It was there he wrote Romans. Which, and we learned of some projects he was had. One of them was to bring an offering to Jerusalem of thanks and solidarity. He wanted to do it himself. He wasn't sure how it would be received by Jews in Palestine. This next project was to carry out his plan to bring gospel to the empire and discharge his obligation to Greeks and barbarians, because he seemed to be the main missionary to the non-Jewish people. Let's see, Romans 1:14. I'm under obligation both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and the foolish. Is how he saw his ministry. And of course, he would have wrote that while he was at Corinthians at that time. As it turned out, it was this Jerusalem journey that brought him under arrest, brought him to Rome. After 2 years of prison in Caesarea, it kind of leads into his final days. Now, little is known of his last days. Some scholars argue that he was released from imprisonment and made other journeys, but there's just not a lot of evidence there because, I mean, you have to think Paul was ministering his first dozen years or so. He didn't write anything. He didn't really start writing things until he was on missionary journeys when he was imprisoned. And so maybe he went and traveled. He just didn't have time to write. Could be. But you would think that somebody, other historians, would have known about that. There's just not a lot of evidence that he did much more after that. Let's see. It's it really is probable that he was executed and probably before 64 AD. And then we get into the influence of Paul's writings, and I think that would be a good topic for another day. The only thing I will say as a hint of foretelling of things to come is, if you think about Paul's letters, it's the earliest body of Christian literature. Amazingly, if you think about it, by modern standards, Paul was really not a systematic theologian. He did his writings are a lot more anecdotal, experiential, metaphorical, and sometimes, but not entirely systematic theology. But anyway, this is a good place to stop, and we can get into what his teaching was actually like, influence of his writing. So let's look forward to that at another day.
Welcome to the Student Ministry Matters podcast. We want to encourage, equip, and connect those with a passion to impact the next generation for Jesus Christ. Student ministry can be a lonely place. You might even feel like you're the only one in your church or community that cares about students. Well, know this, you're not alone. People all across the country are engaging Gen Z and care deeply about the spiritual direction of these young men and women. Whether you're full-time, part-time, bivocational, or volunteer, if you have a heart for students, this is the place for you.
Welcome back to the Student Ministry Matters podcast. My name is Dan Carson, and I'm thrilled that you've chosen to download and listen as we continue the conversation about student ministry. So let's spend some time focused in on what we believe about God, about His Word, about ministry, and we're going to do all of these things because student ministry matters.
Thanks for listening to the Student Ministry Matters podcast. Get connected at studentministrymatters.com or follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Student Ministry Matters. Until next time, keep up the great work with your students because the work matters.
Religionless Christianity with Spencer and Nicole Tosi.
5-minute daily devotionals with Religionless Christianity. Today we're going to be reading and discussing Luke chapter
22. Our proverb of the day comes from chapter 26, verse 24. Whoever hates disguises himself with his lips and harbors deceit in his heart.
And I'm praying for you from Psalm 145. May the Lord show you He is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, that the Lord is good to all, and His mercy is over all that He has made. May you know the Lord is near to all who call on Him, to all who call on Him in truth, that the Lord preserves all who love Him. God bless.
Find out more at religionlesschristianitypodcast.com.
I think as parents, we assume that kids are going to just know the right way to do things. You have to train them by teaching them to do it over and over again until they actually get it.
This is Yvette Hampton, host of the Schoolhouse Rocked podcast. Join us each week for a new episode as we offer encouragement and resources on biblical discipleship from popular speakers and authors, as well as parents just like you and me. Find out more at schoolhouserocked.com or listen anywhere you find your favorite podcast.
All right, and there we have it. I did have to cut the session of this chapter short because there's actually a lot that Paul has done for the early church, a lot of early controversies and heresies even. You know, that thing with the whole circumcision, that was a heresy at the time because it was heretical for Jews to not be circumcised, to eat food from idols and break the dietary restrictions. And it was a heresy, but this is only the tip of the iceberg. Now, for this chapter, we're going to be pushing on beyond that and get more to some of Paul's theology and stuff like that. But in the coming chapters, this is why I wanted to get into this history, is because I just wanted to walk through the early time frame and see how the Christian church has developed in some of the early heresies that have sprung up that amazingly are still with us today. There's still people out there who claim some of these falsehoods. We'll get more about that as time goes on. But for now, that's all I got, really. It's a little bit longer than I thought it was going to be, but it's hopefully not too long for people to not tune me out. Anyway, speaking of tuning out, it's time for me to say this is your host, Keith, signing off. Thanks for listening. Tell a friend about us. And that's how we grow our audience, really. And make sure you do subscribe directly. And with all that, that's all we got. So find us on the web, follow us, support us, send us email, leave me feedback. Always appreciate hearing from listeners to tell us what we should do, what directions we should go. And here is our voice of the podcast to tell you all about how to do that.
Visit life-truth.com, where you can find all our shows. Leave a message or call our voicemail number at 401-753-4844. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/lifetruthpage. Follow us on Twitter at HPNcast, capital H, capital P, capital N, capital C, A-S-T. Everything Nathan Caldwell does can be found at facebook.com/protectorsofthebook. Music in the show is used by permission of Kevin Zerbe at zerbinator.wordpress.com. May God richly bless you. May you find everything you need. And if you don't know Jesus, your greatest need is a Savior. Thanks for listening.